We've seen a lot of product innovation over at Venmo over the last handful of months, and Bank of America out reiterating its price target of $323 and a buy rating on PayPal, of course, Venmo's parent company. And Jason Kupferberg, analyst over at Bank of America, joins us now to talk about the call. Jason, let's start with something you guys discussed in the note, and we were just chatting about a little in the break. This idea of a super app, Venmo being a super app within PayPal. How do you break down, how do you guys at least kind of think about that idea and define it internally?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. So PayPal at the corporate level is pursuing what we would refer to as a super app strategy. The idea being that it becomes a one-stop destination for all types of not just payment related functionality, but different types of personal financial services. And PayPal is in the fortunate position of also owning Venmo, which is really a separate app, but with a lot of similar functionality that the PayPal app has. Venmo certainly is very appealing to a younger demographic and is already north of 70 million active users. And we think that number is going quite a bit higher here in the coming years. But the overall notion of a super app is the idea that it becomes really a one-stop shop for all types of personal financial services, whether it's buying something online, sending money to a friend, paying a bill, buying crypto, investing in equities, et cetera.
Jason, there are two, I would say at least two other competitors to PayPal that appear to have super app ambitions of their own. You have Square out there with the aggressive acquisition of Afterpay. I would even put SoFi in that mix too as well. Why is PayPal's stock a better buy than those two?
So in our opinion, PayPal is very well positioned to be on the short list of global leaders when it comes to these super apps, these fintech apps. Obviously, there's a couple of prominent ones in Asia, like the Alipays of the world. And if you look at what Square has done with their Cash App ecosystem, that's been very impressive as well. With that said, there are some aspects to the PayPal business model that Square does not have, for example, a branded checkout button. Now, they will have a buy now, pay later offering once they close the acquisition of Afterpay, as you referred to. But we think that when you stack up PayPal to the others that are out there, they've just got a broader set of offerings, even though they're all sort of operating in the same genre of super apps. But we think PayPal's got the most complete offering out there. And you're going to continue to see them bolt on additional offerings here in the coming quarters and as we go into 2022.
You know, Jason, there were reports earlier this week that PayPal is maybe exploring stock trading. Certainly, as you noted, you've got the cryptocurrency trading on Venmo. I'm curious how you guys think about that as an engagement driver sort of across, you know, the ecosystem. Everyone now wants a piece, it seems, of some kind of trading capability. How important is that when thinking about, you know, a full suite of financial services, whether it is for Venmo or any of these other, you know, possible, you know, kind of competitors out there?
You hit the nail on the head. It's absolutely an engagement tool. It's not a direct revenue generating type service. Free equity trading has obviously become the norm for retail traders. And so I think PayPal will follow suit in that regard. And because more and more retail investors are obviously active in the markets these days, it becomes one more reason to open the PayPal app or open the Venmo app and perhaps engage with an actual monetizable service in addition to doing the equity trading in this example. So for the most part, what PayPal and Venmo offer are revenue generating services, whether that revenue comes from the consumer or the merchant. But I think equity trading will be an example of one that does not have a direct revenue stream associated with it, but will prove to be an engagement tool. And, you know, you'll essentially get some cross sell out of that.
Jason, there's been argument for some time on PayPal that, you know, PayPal stock or just doesn't reflect the value of Venmo. And some have argued that it should be spun off. Now, in front of it potentially achieving profitability next year, would that be a wise move for PayPal to undertake?
We don't think so. We would not suggest that spinning off Venmo would make sense. I mean, Venmo is a big part of PayPal's growth story. We certainly do think that PayPal as a stock is undervalued here. The stock came in following earnings about a month ago, and that was really purely related to some weakness in the eBay side of the business, which is already known to be deconverting in part off of the PayPal platform. So that was simply a timing issue. In fact, the business excluding eBay, PayPal actually raised their revenue guidance for 2021, excluding eBay. And so we think that should have been the bigger takeaway from the print. Venmo is certainly part of the value creation equation here, as the business is expected to more than break even on an operating profit basis in 2022. And certainly from a revenue perspective, as we described in our note earlier this week, you know, we think you're going to see some significant growth, both in terms of new users as well as average revenue per user, or ARPU, as we look out through 2023.
All right, we'll leave it there. Jason Kupferberg, analyst over at Bank of America. Jason, really appreciate the time this morning.
Consumers are buying stuff that gets them back to school, back to the office. And what we are seeing is rise in stuff that really gets them to school, things like bedding, storage and organization, wall decor on the home side. And on the clothing side, it's stuff that gets you out. Look, suits, jackets, heels, ties. These are all up both month over month and year over year in terms of their consumption. If you focus just on Gen Z, which is the younger generation going back to school, we see classic brands like Lululemon certainly holding the roost, but then you see up and coming brands like Princess Polly and Girlfriend Collective. These are all brands popularized by TikTok that are also trending on Poshmark.
And I know you recently linked up with Snapchat. What precisely are you doing on Snapchat? And has that partnership led to any increase in business for you?
Yeah, Snapchat Mini is our offering in partnership with Snapchat, where we offer native Poshmark shopping. And you can really load it up as a lens, share your shopping, shop with friends. It's early. We just launched it in mid-July. And we're definitely seeing an uptick in that whole area and working with Snapchat for continuing to iterate on that product.
And Manish, I'm curious in terms of style, how that may have changed as we emerge out of the pandemic. What are the indications that you guys are seeing in terms of what people want to be wearing that is maybe different than sort of what the predominating style was, let's say, circa fall of 19?
Yeah, a lot of the style today is rooted in vintage. You might have heard the trending 90s style, Y2K, high-waisted pants, crop tops, stuff that really was popular 20 years back is coming back. And what you see with a secondhand and vintage is really a consumer that's picking up styles and discarding it very quickly. And some of it has to do with social media, some of it has to do with pandemic, and some of it has to do with the fact that buying and selling secondhand is very much part of this generation's DNA.
You know, there has been some concern, Manish, on Poshmark's ability just to retain its users and its sellers. How would you respond to that? Have you seen that change, that dynamic change, I guess, as the economy has reopened?
Well, number one, I think when you start to think of what people are doing today is they are thinking of their closet as not just a closet, but really a boutique. And from day one, we've sort of turned your closet into a boutique. So instead of your closet being something where you put stuff in it and then it goes to landfill or trash, in Poshmark's case, the closet becomes a living, breathing part of your business, part of your day-to-day. And that trend is only accelerating. So when you think of the future of shopping, what we see it, number one, people want simplicity. They want to be able to go to one place, buy all kinds of trends and styles. That's what Poshmark offers. They want sustainability, not just sustainability from an environmental perspective, but also economic perspective. And they want to be able to ask questions, talk, stuff that's actually not happening in the real world. Out there. So when you think of simple, social, sustainable, we believe that's the future of shopping. And that is all centered around stuff that we offer. And we sit at the cross section of all these three trends.
You know, Manish, you guys ramped up your marketing in the most recent marketing spend in the most recent quarter. And you talked a little on the call about you were lapping kind of a pullback in the same quarter last year. But as you talk about those different channels, and I think of this, you know, the Snapchat agreement, what's the influencer channel for you guys right now? How do you think about that as a lever to pull on the marketing side? What have you done? What are you not interested in there?
Yeah, we think of influencers as really three buckets. Number one is our community, and many of our sellers have become people who have millions of followers, both on Poshmark and beyond. And these folks are out there evangelizing and talking about how we are a much more sustainable, much better way to shop and sell. Second is sort of classic celebrities. So these are the big celebs that are there, whether you think of a sports celeb like Serena Williams, who sits on our board, or someone who's sort of maybe more coming from the music world. And third is sort of the more influencers who are being born with new social media platforms, whether you look at TikTok or Instagram. And all three programs are bunched into something we call the Posh Affiliate Program. And that's something that we've been scaling in a very cost-efficient way on the on Poshmark.
You know, Manish, since the last time we talked, that Etsy deal for Depop, $1.6 billion, that has a lot of folks in the resale market talking. Now, if I have it right, Depop has half the take rate as Poshmark. Are you going to have to lower your take rate?
So number one, I think when you start to think of take rate, you got to look at all of the different fees. For day one, our approach to take rate has been to have one simple fee, which includes everything. It includes your marketplace fees, your payment fees, your transaction processing, your shipping, et cetera. So all of that is included. A lot of the other marketplaces end up unbundling these areas. And that approach is something we've taken from day one. You know, in 2011, when we started, our take rate was a partnership with our sellers, where our sellers got to keep 80%. It's 2021. We have not touched that take rate in over 10 years. And that's something where, when you look at classic marketplaces, including Etsy, they've sort of doubled and tripled their take rate. And in many transactions, they'll take over 25% of your sales.
Manish, before I let you go, I do want to ask about the stock price. So the first trade for Poshmark, $97.50 back in January when you IPO'd. Right now, the stock is at about $29. Are you disappointed with the market reaction? Is there something that the market is missing here?
Well, first of all, I think we continue to focus on our long-term strategies, and that's sort of been our focus from day one. And a lot of it has to do with continuing to grow our user base, you know, grow globally. We most recently announced we'll be entering India. We launched Australia in February, and these markets will take some time to develop, but these are huge markets and huge opportunities for us. Third is really category expansion. When you think about Poshmark, 10 years back, we started very much focused on women's fashion. Today, we've expanded to men's, kids, new and old fashion, as well as home and beauty and wellness, and most recently, pets. So these categories also allow both the buyers and sellers to have more things that they can participate on the platform. And the last thing is continuing to innovate on our core platform. Most recently, for example, we've started to add trend-based merchandising using style tags on the platform. And these are all things that the modern shopper and seller want besides brand-based merchandising. So we continue to invest in the platform, continue to focus, and we think the stock market will catch up as they understand the power of the Poshmark social platform.
Fair enough. Poshmark CEO Manish Chandra, always good to see you. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
The Department of Education has canceled more than $9 billion in student debt under the Biden administration. But with Americans owing roughly $1.7 trillion in debt, our next guest says the student debt issue isn't just a crisis, but a catastrophe. Let's bring in Josh Mitchell. He is a reporter at The Wall Street Journal. He's out with a new book, The Debt Trap, How Student Loans Became a National Catastrophe. We've also got Yahoo Finance's R.T. Swaminathan joining in on the conversation. Josh, this is certainly a very important issue. I know R.T. has covered extensively, but we've often referred to this as a crisis. What elevates it to a catastrophe?
Sure. Well, let's just offer a point of comparison. At the height of the housing crisis, roughly 9% of mortgage debt was 3 months behind. If you take a look at where student debt stood in terms of how much was 3 months behind, as of January 2020, before the pandemic, it was about 20% or more. This is according to the New York Fed. So even in a good economy, one in five people with student debt in the repayment cycle are consistently behind. There are about 8 million people or so who have defaulted on their loans, which is a very high threshold. You have to go a year without making a payment. That's roughly in the same ballpark of the number of people who lost their homes to foreclosure during the housing crisis. If you look at how much debt is what I would call toxic debt, meaning it's never going to get repaid. Anywhere from, you know, a third or more of this debt is not going to get repaid, according to a report that took place under the Trump administration. That's approaching the amount of toxic debt that was on private lenders' books during the housing crash. If you look at how many senior citizens are having their Social Security checks reduced because of unpaid student debt, that's hundreds of thousands a year, according to a GAO study. So there are a number of ways to look at how many people are struggling to repay their debt. And any way you look at it, these are very high numbers of people.
Josh, you have spent a lot more time than me looking into this issue, but in your book, you take us back to a time when this sort of just got started. And what struck me was that at many points, there were red flags that kind of arose, but why was no one strong enough to be able to say, look, I think there's something wrong? Was it be it the universities or officials? I mean, why were accountability measures not, introduced earlier in the phase before this became a full-blown crisis?
Well, I think that's a good point, and there were good intentions along the way. The program really started to get ramped up in the 1960s when, just as now, there was this big push to reduce inequality, to, you know, help poor people move into the middle class. This came in the thick of the civil rights movement, and so there was this good intention to give everyone the opportunity to go to college. And college was seen as the surefire investment. And so, at every step along the way, Congress was very reluctant to cut off anyone's access to college. And it just became the path of least resistance to give people loans. And it became very easy to ignore the fact that a lot of people were defaulting on their loans, and a lot of people lied to themselves about the fact that people would repay this debt. Mm-hmm. Congress just applied rosy colored glasses to this program throughout the years and said, look, we need to give our constituents access to student loans. This is a good investment. And now there are also a lot of interests that fought against any changes to this program. We can't ignore that. Whether it was Sallie Mae, whether it was banks, whether it was other higher education groups, I quote, then Vice President George H.W. Bush saying every time the Reagan administration talked about, putting in place changes to this program to really hold colleges' feet to the fire, presidents would, visit him in his office and say, no, you can't cut off the student loan program. That's our economic lifeblood. So, every time someone talked about this, there were people banging on lawmakers' doors saying you can't do this because then there will be another type of economic catastrophe, which is that, people won't have access to this golden ticket to the middle class.
Yeah. And Josh, I mean, when we look at maybe what pressure is now facing the Biden administration to get this done, I mean, they did also cancel loans for students who had gone to ITT and other kind of considerations. But progressives keep pushing for kind of wider blanket student debt cancellations. The moratorium, once that lifts in January, people are going to be repaying this debt. So, I mean, what's the likelihood? We had heard some promises that a lot would get canceled when you listen to progressives. What's the likelihood that that ever actually happens?
It doesn't look like it's going to happen. President Biden has consistently said this is something Congress likely has to do and that the White House can't do by executive action. Congress keeps on pointing to the White House saying, no, you should do this through executive action. Of course, you have the legal authority to do it. So they're just pointing fingers at each other. And I think that is evidence in and of itself that, this is not likely to happen, this blanket forgiveness. I think we could, just look at the statements from the administration. They have raised doubts about doing that. So what they're doing is a piecemeal approach where, they are arguing that they do have these measures in place already under the law to help specific groups, but not through blanket forgiveness.
Josh, I'm curious about what you found about bankruptcy and basically how it evolved through the years. Do you think there is more consensus now that maybe we can do bankruptcy reform instead of pursuing the forgiveness route, which is kind of a little bit more of a sensitive solution?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. There is a bipartisan consensus. The Trump administration had concerns about the lack of bankruptcy protection for students, as did the Obama administration. Members of Congress have said that. The big obstacle I've always thought stood in the way of bankruptcy changes is it will ultimately show up as a cost in the government's budget. If you say all of a sudden, a lot of more students than currently can file for bankruptcy, ultimately, if they do file for bankruptcy, taxpayers are going to, have to absorb those losses. And so that will show up as a cost. And as you've seen over the years, Congress fights a lot over spending. That being said, I do think there's a consensus here. I think the other issue that we have to keep in mind is that bankruptcy happens at the end of the process. You know, what about the start of the process? And so a lot of the measures that are in place to address student debt or some of the problems I lay out in my book, a lot of them, again, are coming at the back end. There isn't as much talk about what happens at the front end. You know, if you just keep on issuing student debt in the same fashion, which is basically giving families a blank check, you're just going to have more and more families end up in unrepayable debts over the years. And it doesn't really solve the underlying issue.
Josh, what do you think the calculation has been on the side of colleges and universities? We've obviously seen declining enrollment. There are concerns about, you know, how they sort of make up the losses. A lot of these universities felt during the pandemic, too. But I wonder if you've seen a shift in the way they think about the value of that tuition at a time where students are clearly rethinking the value.
One of the more interesting shifts that's happened over the past 5 or 10 years has been that inflation and tuition has gone down. It's still rising. You know, tuition is still rising, but not at the pace that it had been rising. And I think that's partly reflective of the market forces that you just described. Enrollment has gone down. I do think since 2010, I do think that families are becoming more cost conscious. Polls show that the share of families who say college is worth it, that share among the public has gone down. So I think in just a few years. So, and we also see that consumers, families, students are becoming more aware just through the availability of data put out by the education department of what you can expect to earn when you go into a certain program in a certain college. So, you know, I think in some ways these shifts are positive for families. And I think colleges are increasingly they're under pressure to rein in their tuition increases. So that's one positive development I think we've seen.
The issue of student debt is certainly something a lot of our viewers can relate to. Josh, it's great to talk to you today. Josh Mitchell joining us from The Wall Street Journal. Well, the gradual return to bars is providing a lift to the company behind Jameson Whiskey and Absolut Vodka. Pernod Ricard saw sales in the first half of the year jump about 10%, with total revenue and operating profits returning to pre-COVID levels. In the U.S. specifically, the company saw sales jump 16%. Let's bring in the global chairman and CEO of Pernod Ricard. We've got Alex Ricard joining us today, along with Yahoo Finance's Brian Sazi. And Alex, it's great to talk to you today. It does feel like things are sort of slowly starting to return. And yet with so many of these businesses, especially bars, we've been asking that question about the impact the Delta variant is having on traffic coming in too. How do things look like right now from where you stand?
Listen, we've had a great year, as you mentioned, with our net sales growing by 10% over the last 12 months, which is an excellent performance, growing from every single region around the world, with the obvious exception of global travel retail for understandable reasons. And as you mentioned, our sales in the U.S. Grew by 16% and hit the $2 billion net sales milestone for us there. This is driven, first of all, by the remarkable resilience of the off-trade of home consumption, but as well, and we're seeing this happen, is also impacted positively by the reopening of the on-trade, and consumers are really eager to go back out and socialize and meet friends and so on and so forth in the on-trade, but it's also driven by the remarkable acceleration of e-commerce. So, all in all, we did have a great year, and we expect, despite sanitary restrictions, we do expect to see good sales momentum continue for this current year because of what I explained, especially resilience of the off-trade and reopening of the on-trade.
Alex, Brian here. China, key market for the liquor industry, of course, you are included in that. How big a headwind will it be to your business now that China is, in fact, trying to crack down on wealth?
Well, my understanding when I listen to the news on Yahoo Finance is what China is trying to do. They're trying to support the growth and emergence of middle class households. And in fact, this Chinese middle class households are indeed what the core of what we focus on in China. So the fact to support income for middle class Chinese households from that point of view could be seen as a positive.
Yeah, when we look at kind of the forward guidance here, we've seen some companies kind of be hesitant to look a little bit farther out and give any quantitative guidance. You say that the quarter or the year is going to be dynamic. I mean, talk to me about maybe what's making it difficult. I know Delta's out there, but what are kind of the biggest question marks you have around why you wouldn't want to be more specific there?
You know, there are huge swings by channel, as you can imagine. So, we go from, if I take the example of the on-trade, in some markets, you see declines of 60, 70, 80% turn into growth rates of 150, 200%, or even 300%. So there are huge swings by channel. The situation varies quite significantly from one market to another. So there's also a mix of markets, a mix of brands, a mix of format in an environment which is still quite volatile and where the sanitary crisis is still not over. So we were confident enough and clearly to mention that we expect to see good sales momentum. We clearly expect as well a very dynamic Q1 off of a low base. Last year, Q1 was down 6%. But to start giving more specific numbers at this stage would not be extremely prudent.
Now, Alex, what is the consolidation in the liquor industry? It has continued. It's continued throughout the pandemic. What is not in your portfolio that you would like to see in your portfolio?
Listen, we have a clear strategy of dynamic management of our portfolio. So we're on the hunt for great emerging craft super premium brands that are out there. We've been very active over the last few years, and as you mentioned, as well during the pandemic, we've made a number of partnership or acquisitions, such as Malfi Gin, Monkey 47 Gin, amazing American whiskeys, Rabbit Hole Bourbon, which is great, Jefferson Bourbon, which is amazing, TX Whiskey, which is also fantastic, or Smooth Ambler, just to name but a few, but as well Del Maguey, which is the leading craft mezcal brand out there. And I could go on, including other opportunities we've partnered with in Europe, such as Italicus, which is an Italian bergamot liqueur. And you should expect to see more of that in the coming months and years. We intend to be quite dynamic. We have a pretty extensive portfolio of brands. We don't have any very specific white spaces. We're probably underexposed to some categories, such as tequila, of course. But we have two amazing tequila brands with Tequila Avion and Tequila Altos. So anyways, we are out there on the lookout, and you should expect to see more of that in the coming future.
Alex, why is that still so hot?
Listen, you always have cycles. Tequila is a great segment. You can do great cocktails with tequila. Margarita is one of the best selling cocktails in the U.S. So right now, tequila is hot, but cognac is quite hot as well. And U.S. Super premium and above whiskey is quite hot as well. So there are many categories that are quite hot. It is driven by big, strong brands. It is also driven by cocktail and mixology. We saw a lot of that. It is now increasingly driven by convenience as well through the e-commerce channel. And so we're quite positive on the segments I mentioned.
Been interesting to see the shift in the space there during the pandemic. But Alexander Ricard, it's good to talk to you today, Global Chairman and CEO of Pernod Ricard. And our thanks to Brian Sozzi, too, for joining in on the conversation.
Well, if you're like me, you might be overwhelmed with all the streaming options out there. And when one kind of gets stale with the content, you might look towards canceling, moving over to another. So how important are those tent poles for each platform? Our next guest says rather important, especially when you focus in on Netflix and what they have coming out next year in terms of new seasons. of some of my favorites. Don't know if your favorites are the same, but Stranger Things coming out. And for more on what it means for the streaming wars, happy to bring on our next guest, Nat Schindler here, Bank of America Senior Internet Digital Media Analyst, joins us alongside Yahoo Finance's Alexander Canal in the discussion. And Nat, your note kind of walks through the bumps that we see for Netflix subscribers when they do have new content in those major releases. Talk to me about what people should be expecting for what it means on the subscriber front.
Well, I want to be careful to say it's not necessarily on subscribers. It's definitely on app downloads and usage. That when you see some of these temple titles, whether it's Stranger Things, everybody talks about, The Witcher, Lucifer, Ozarks, Cobra Kai, a lot of these titles bring in people into usage and into app downloads, probably relates to subscribers as well, but it is difficult to prove that from the data.
And Nat, I'm very excited for a lot of that second slate content coming out for Netflix, Sex Education, you being some of the many shows that I'm excited to watch. And You is an interesting story because it first debuted on Lifetime, but really didn't see that pop until it came over to Netflix, thus leading to all of those additional seasons. And we are seeing a similar story play out with Manifest. That was on NBC. NBC canceled that series. Fans freaked out. Netflix stepped in, and now they will be producing and releasing one final last season for Manifest. So it seems like Netflix is this redemptive character in a world of bad, evil cable providers. So what do you think this all says when it comes to the future of cable, especially as streamers seem more in tune with where consumers are and have a better a way of pushing out and elevating that content?
Well, I think it goes to the ability of a asynchronous streaming platform that makes its money from subscriptions is just much easier for it to monetize content. So a show like Manifest, or even shows that were quite popular on Fox, like Lucifer at one point, they can falter. And if they lose audience at that time, they can't generate the ad dollars to pay for the show. So they have to be canceled, or they can't justify the usage of that slot. Well, there are no slots on Netflix. And if the dollars can justify it from bringing in subscribers, then it's worth it to them. So they can bring back shows that are real, you know, crowd favorites. And they can actually get them to a much bigger distribution. At this point, most TV networks have a fraction of the usage. Actually, all TV networks have a fraction of the viewership that Netflix has. So you can expand the value of any piece of content by shifting it off of NBC, CBS, Fox, ABC, and moving it onto Netflix. And plus, it goes into global distribution as opposed to just the US.
Nat, I wonder if you can speak to the competitive landscape here. We're talking about shows on Netflix that have been around for years now, especially if you think about something like Stranger Things. What other streaming service has that kind of franchise that can continue to keep people coming back to the service?
Well, clearly that's what Disney has. That's Disney's value, is its franchises. Disney isn't really making content that isn't franchises. That's what they do. It's they're driving their entire use case based on Star Wars and Marvel and Disney princesses. And those are powerful, and I don't doubt that. But I really want to push back on this phrase competition. I've always thought that's interesting. Everybody seems to think that the streaming networks compete. And I guess in a sense they do, but in reality, to a consumer, consumers don't watch networks. They don't subscribe to, I need a streaming service this month, so I should get because I hear they're important to have streaming services. No, they want to watch shows. So what matters is what content is on a network. They want to watch Stranger Things. They have to watch it on Netflix. There is no other option. They want to watch WandaVision. They have to watch it on Disney, and that's all there is. The difference between Netflix and the other streaming services really comes down into the amount of content they release and how broad they can get. Netflix is trying to be that platform that has something for everybody. Disney isn't trying to be that. They have their family targeted. They have some of their tentpole Star Wars and Marvel, and that's about it. You're not going to see the Crown style content on Disney.
And Nat, you bring up an interesting point that it is really all about the shows, but we are seeing Netflix getting into video games. They have the Netflix shop where viewers can go and buy merch from some of their favorite shows. But one of the things that was always unique about Netflix than, say, a Disney Plus is that streaming was the only thing that they were focused on. Do you think as they introduce these other ancillary businesses, it's going to impact that focus that has gotten them to where they are today?
Well, count me as one of the guys who's very skeptical on this over belief in these new businesses. I have, when they came out with their big talk about moving into gaming, they caveated and said it's mobile gaming about their current content. This is marketing, as is the Netflix shop. They're not going to make a lot of money, anything that really moves the needle, selling Stranger Things merch. But that merchandise might get people excited about Stranger Things and thus subscribe to Netflix. So I find all these things just fairly interesting marketing ideas until I see them really stepping up to the console wars or stepping in with really big, expensive hit games on the Call of Duty level. I don't see them really in gaming. They're in marketing of their titles with games.
Yeah, it all goes back to streaming, much like Amazon, and all going back to signing up for Prime too. I mean, that's another kind of way to think about it, I suppose. But Nat Schindler, Bank of America senior internet digital media analyst, joining us here today alongside Yahoo Finance's Alec Now. Appreciate you both for the conversation. I will anxiously await the return of Stranger Things.
I want to get to our next guest now and continue this markets conversation with a focus on jobs. We've got Neela Richardson with us. She is chief economist at ADP. Neela, great to see you again. It's been a while since you've been on my show. And I want to start with this ADP report coming from your firm showing that private payrolls did expand last month, but by not nearly as much as Wall Street had hoped for. Is that the Delta variant sort of making its way now through the job market?
Alexis, it's great to be with you. I hope you had a great summer. Look, there's a couple of things that we think are at play in terms of this month's numbers. The Delta variant may be meaningfully impacting the pace of hires in the second half of the year. There's a lot of uncertainty surrounding that. But also remember that labor shortages have been a key hurdle, especially for small firms that can't compete as much with those larger firms who can trick out their compensation plans or offer some bonuses and different structures to attract workers. So you're seeing the conflation of bottlenecks in the labor market with this ongoing pandemic that's stayed around far too long, but continues to meaningfully drive the jobs market recovery.
Now, I know in months past, the ADP report doesn't necessarily line up with the government unemployment report, which is out just a couple of days after. What are your expectations for that August unemployment report? Because I know the consensus on the street is for an additional 750,000 jobs added. That seems mighty aggressive and mighty optimistic and an unemployment rate of 5.2%. Where do you stand?
You know, Alexis, those consensus estimates have a wide range even within them. We tend to talk about the median or the average, but there is a big range, and that's attributable to the uncertainty we've seen and the unevenness of the recovery. We think that the growth is still robust, and you'll see that in the BLS numbers, but we can't expect million plus job gains for the foreseeable future. Remember, the street was calling for that in January. We will see this unevenness in the monthly gains, I think, going forward. And just to put a little button on it, year-to-date, ending in July, ADP has calculated 3.4 million jobs on net created. The BLS numbers over the same period is 3.7. So lots of monthly variance, but the overall trend has been in line.
Neela, you know, we saw a number of states that cut off those enhanced employment benefits early. It looks like they didn't see a significant boost in job growth. There was a Wall Street Journal analysis that took a closer look at that. Why do you think that is?
Because that wasn't the whole story. It wasn't just about the enhanced unemployment benefits. It was really what the health conditions were on the ground and the fact that we are still in the midst of an ongoing pandemic. So some states that ended or phased out benefits saw a meaningful pickup in hiring. And those who didn't end benefits or phase them out already also saw a meaningful pickup in hiring. And then there were states who didn't see a meaningful. So there's a lot of noise there. We're still trying to figure out the role of enhanced benefits, but it's clear that there's much more going on in this labor market than just whether or not unemployed workers have more support going forward.
And speak about a range and expectations for this unemployment report. There's also a big range out there amongst economists talking about when are we going to get back to pre-pandemic levels for the job market. Some are saying it's going to take to the end of this decade. Do you think it's really going to take that long to make the job market whole again?
I don't, but we still have significant challenges ahead. The service sector in particular is poised to add most of the gains, but it's still 5 million short of where it was pre-pandemic, and we're still seeing 7 million workers sidelined by the pandemic. So yes, there is challenges ahead, but we've also seen an amazing economic recovery, a huge pickup in business formation. Financial liquidity is there and present in terms of ADP's small business surveys. You know, it's hiring, not financing, that is the number one challenges that we are seeing our small business clients report. So this is really a market that could thrive given economic conditions, but is limited by labor market bottlenecks and health conditions that are uncertain.
Neela, how critical is tomorrow's or Friday's jobs report to the Federal Reserve, and of course that all-important wage component, which could signal a bump up in already rising inflation?
You know, the Fed has started to signal what it would like to see. It would like to see, and we all would, frankly, this continual pickup in job gains, because that allows them to take their foot off the gas again a bit, taper some of those bond purchases, eventually increase interest rates, and gives them back the ammunition they may need if there is another downturn. So I do think that this August jobs report is a critical input into that overall plan A. And if it's lower than expected, that shifts to a plan B, where they're more accommodative for longer than they'd like to be.
All right. We're a lot to sift through on Friday for sure. Neela Richardson, chief economist at ADP, thanks so much for being with us. Welcome back. There is a new bourbon brand in town, and chances are you're going to recognize the co-founders, actors Ian Somerhalder and Paul Wesley. Yep, they've gone from being brothers on the popular CW show Vampire Diaries to launching the Brothers Bond Bourbon. And we are so delighted to have them here with us now. Guys, thanks so much for being with us. You got your bottle. You're ready to go. Look, congratulations. I know when this bourbon launched in May, you started selling it online, and it sold out within days. Ian, I'm going to toss this one to you. What was the inspiration for doing this with your friend Paul?
You know what? This is over 10 years in the making. This guy and I spent so many thousands and thousands of hours on a set together. And this is the most authentic thing that we could think of doing. You know, this is our soul is in this bottle. And I think you'd be hard pressed to find a product that this uncompromising quality with this level of IP built into the product. So we're really, really grateful and humbled.
Paul, what was it like building this bourbon brand from the ground up, especially during a pandemic? How'd you guys do it?
You know, I mean, in first of all, we've been talking about doing this for 10 years and we built this for the last few years. But I have to say, in a way, I mean, obviously it was a horrible time, but at the same time, it forced us to sit in our homes, get on our Zooms, talk every single day and develop this product. Ian and I live close to one another, so I went to Ian's. We blended this bourbon together in his living room
for over a year.
For over a year. We created this. We created the label. We came up with the name. So everything we did, we had obviously a lot of time on our hands. So in a way, it was serendipitous. I hate to say that, but in a way, it sort of worked out to our favor. And it was such a beautiful passion project. And here we are on Yahoo Finance talking about it. And we're just so humbled and thrilled to be here.
And we just announced a huge announcement 48 hours ago. 50,000 cases sold in the first 4 months after launch is pretty substantial. And we're just super humbled and really grateful to everyone.
That is crazy good. What's the price point? What's it selling for?
$39.99.
Yep.
Okay, that's pretty reasonable. And I love the bottle. I love the look of it. We were talking during the break. I think I'm going to open up my bottle over the holiday weekend. Talk to us about the label. It's a tree with, is that the two of you sitting under the tree?
Yeah, we always argue who's who, but yeah, right. That's me and that's Ian.
Yeah, it's better angle of Paul.
That's right. It's not right side. Better. No, but this it's go ahead and an arbitrary label.
No, I mean, yeah. It's super symbolic, obviously, right? The brothers bond is the anchor that holds this big, you know, organic of structure in between the boys. They have the ability to be safe and look out and have perspective. These are the grains actually built in, you know, the corn, wheat, barley, and rye built into the tree. And the birds signify nature and freedom.
And the tree is an oak tree. And as we all know, bourbon is aged in oak barrels. Yep. So yeah. Everything has a meaning and a significance.
Yeah, new American oak. And so every bit of it, like Paul said, has significance. It's very, very organic. And it feels to us that sort of sense of like, nostalgia, solid, you know, purity
and bonding, togetherness,
bonding and inspiration, because nature and each, you know, nature inspires us and protects us as do you inspire me and protect me.
Thanks, buddy.
No, it's really special.
You guys, that is awesome. Thanks for the show and tell and for explaining the label for us. So look, it's no surprise to you. There are lots of celebrity backed brands out there of spirits, of alcohol. You know, how do you distinguish yourself and get seen and, you know, build on what you're having right now, the success, and not just sort of be like a flash in the pan?
Well, yeah, Ian loves to call himself a celebrity.
First of all, let me set it right straight. We do everything in our power not to call one another or refer to ourselves as celebrities.
But I'll just say really quickly, and then I'll hand it off to Ian. But, you know, every single thing, you know, as you said, there's a lot of celebrity brands out there. Most people, and I'm not saying specific names or anything, but most people will slap their names on a bottle and, you know, sell a product that they really had no part in developing. Everything you see here, from the label to the name to the mash bill inside to the bottle, was designed by Ian and myself and our team. And so for us, this is extremely organic. Also, for those of you who don't know, Ian and I were on a show called The Vampire Diaries. We played brothers. We drank bourbon on the show. Ian and I drank bourbon off screen when we finished work. We fell in love with bourbon. We shot it in the South, the show in the South. And so, you know, this is extremely organic to us. And it's something that just makes perfect sense.
It's also, too, about the ethos of this company is about bringing people together, right? And I think we can all sort of agree that we need togetherness ultimately more now than ever in history. And Brothers Bond is the company to do that. We encourage a deep sense of community and belonging. It's inclusive, not exclusive.
And you want to mention the agriculture?
Yeah, 100%. Like, listen, we all know that there a give back component, particularly up and down the supply chain of any new company coming into the fold, is absolutely necessary. The future of business are the companies with triple bottom lines: people, planet, profit. End of story, right? So we're giving back to regenerative agriculture. We obviously know scientifically regenerative agriculture can stop climate change in its tracks, put it in our rearview mirror. So we are doubling down and putting our money where our mouth is, not just as a company, but as individuals, and encouraging our partners and our families. I mean, this is what we do. We are an agriculture company, and we are going to make sure that we invest heavily, heavily, heavily in regenerative ag by sequestering enormous amounts of carbon dioxide and storing it safely back in the ground where it belongs.
Well, we like that component of the whole situation here. Spoken like true, you know, co-founders and CEOs, Ian Somerhalder, Paul Wesley. Thanks so much, guys, and best of luck with the bourbon.
There's no way I would be – our CEO, Vincent Hanna, runs the company. There's no way I would trust either one of us to be CEOs of this company.
That's right.
Hey, well, you got the lingo down.
Right, enjoy. Thank you for this, Yahoo. Thank you.
Absolutely. Enjoy the bourbon. Enjoy your long holiday weekend.